ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. And today's Friday, and we are going to have James Corbett, my conversation with him for the second and third segment of the program today. And with that, with me being live for the first segment today, I'm going to bring you my opinion and commentary on everything that is happening economically and some of these political events for Friday, August 23rd, 2019. I mean, it's just a crazy, crazy day out there, but yet it's a very quiet day, and I'm not quite sure with everything that's going on. I think people are just amazed, stunned, confident, perhaps. Maybe this is the way it's supposed to be. To some degree, part of me is saying right on, and the other part of me is saying right off. I mean, it is just very strange world we live in with all this chaos, and we'll be hitting some of these peak headlines for my first 20 minutes today. But, you know, I got to talk about gold today, and what a fabulous day. You know, when we talk about the fabulous days that gold is having, you know, as we continue this increase, you know, it's really a double-edged sword, because as the prices of gold rise, we get more confusion, more chaos, more extremes, more danger. It becomes more frightening as the prices of gold rise. And we can always scream about the price of gold being manipulated and being suppressed. But on the other hand, when they have it suppressed, you know, things, whether we agree with them or not, to some degree, things are controlled, whether we like it or not. And we're heading into some very dangerous times. But the gold today was up $30.50 in the New York spot price after market, up a little over 2%. And that climbed back. We were below 1500 this morning. Silver was up 43 cents. That was up 2.5%, $17.53. The other white metals, you have platinum, was up a buck, 861. Palladium was down 24 at 1469. And, you know, the one metal I don't talk about very often, that's rhodium. And, you know, it's up 5% today, up $195. So I saw rhodium in the mid-2000s, about 2004, 2005. We saw it go from $400 to $10,000. And I always used rhodium as an example of a precious metals, even though it's not a monetary metal. It's a precious metal, but and an industrial metal. But we saw something go from $400 to $10,000. And that's exactly what we're going to see gold do. So it gives you the visual of what gold is going to do, what I believe it's going to do. I don't know the time frame. We didn't know the time frame for rhodium. It just took off and never stopped. There's big ups, there's big downs, but you have to look at the long-term picture. And now we're looking to gold as a monetary metal. This monetary metal, one of our biggest problems in our economy. It's all monetary policy. So absolutely, gold is going to continue in this fiat world that we live in, the world that has been synchronized so that these economies can show some gains. This would have collapsed earlier if we hadn't done the tax cuts. Yeah, that was a stimulus. That's quantitative easing to some degree. The economy had to be stimulated. There's discussions today of lowering that corporate rate to 15%. That's how desperate. This is how desperate things are, how dire things are. And the U.S. dollar today was down 0.59. That's all they can get out of that, 97.61. Everybody knows government needs a weaker dollar, period. And this is not historic highs on the dollar and the index and the USDX in the basket of currencies. This is not a high, not by any means. But it's high for government because they need that inflation. Crude oil down 1.53 at 53.82. And let's see what the stock markets, I've kind of been going just a little bit slow to see the final numbers peek through. The Dow was down most of the day, At least the last couple of hours, down 500 points. The last half hour or so, it dropped 623 points today. It was down 2.37%, 25,628. Now the NASDAQ took a beating. It was down 3% today, 7,751, down 239 points. The S&P down 7. That's where most everybody's at. That's where your mom and pops, everyone gets affected by the NASDAQ being down 3%. Same way with the S&P is down 2.5, a little over 2.5%, 2,847. The 10-year yield down over 5%, 1.53%. And I guess we had another inverted yield today. Asian markets and European markets were flat overnight. And you know what? I often talk about the fear and greed index. And just as a reminder, they use seven fear and greed indicators. This is a CNN business. And the CBO Volatility Index, the VIX, is at 20.39. It is above its 50-day moving average. And it shows that there's a little bit of concern out there that investors might have about their near-term values of their portfolios. And so that's one of the factors that they use in order to calculate this fear and greed that I talk about on the program often. They also use put and call options. They use stock price strength. They use stock price breadth. And they use market momentum. And they put that all together. They also put in junk bond demand and safe haven demand. So all of these are put into this little index that they've created. And they come out with this fear and greed index between 0 and 100, with 0 being extreme fear. 50 being neutral and 100 being extreme greed. Now we've been in this fear level, which they consider extreme fear, about 22. We've been holding 22, 23, 24 for a long time. Personally, I'd be closer to zero. I think people should be mighty concerned about what's driving the markets right now. And they often say that only investors, normal people, your pensions, your 401s, you get excited when it goes up, you lose money when it goes down. But traders, big investors and traders, they make more money with the markets going down than they do going up. And and I It's so they're doing fine, but it's what I guess the normal people who've worked hard, who have pension plans, retirement accounts, those are the ones that are going to get hit so hard by the adjustments that we're going to see here in the very near future. So back to the fear and greed index, it's 24, as I mentioned. It is considered extreme fear, but there's no panic out there, ladies and gentlemen. No panic, and we should be panicked. And some of the reasons, here's something too. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, she undergoes more cancer treatments today. Pancreatic tumor, it's malignant. She's not going to, we know those that have pancreatic cancer, they're 6 months sometimes. So seems like President Trump will be appointing someone to replace her. So that was probably one of my main reasons why I voted for President Trump, that I did support him, because I just couldn't imagine the whole Supreme Court being liberal. Oh my gosh. So at least we got something good there for us right now. But a lot of things going on today. Let me go ahead. I only have 20 minutes today, so. What's going on in the markets today? President Trump reacted. He was furious today after Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell linked the trade war with China to risk to the U.S. economy, asking whether the man he handpicked to run the U.S. Central Bank was a greater enemy than Chinese leader Xi Jinping. So he's not only calling Jerome Powell an enemy, but also Chairman Xi. And it just was a couple of weeks ago that he said they were best buddies, Chairman Xi of China. China was always an enemy. Don't you forget it. And so, but this is President Trump says, as usual, the Fed did nothing. It is incredible that they can speak without knowing or asking what he is doing, which will be announced shortly. We have a very strong dollar, a very weak Fed. I will work brilliantly with both. The U.S. will do great. It's not quite sure what Trump meant when he says he's going to be working with both. And the White House did not respond for any type of comment. And of course, we all know that Trump has repeatedly accused the Fed of making monetary policy too tight. And of course, that makes he boosted the value of the dollar and uncut the economic growth. That's not the only thing that's cutting our economic growth, ladies and gentlemen. Probably hampered it somewhat as those things were getting higher. Credit card debt. Yeah, consumers can't use their credit card debt. I mean, if their interest rates are rising on their credit cards, those minimum payments isn't going to work very well. One minute you have a $40 a month interest fee. The next month you have $100. That's going to put a damper on your out there spending. But yet we're told that retail is the strongest thing out there. So maybe the consumers did like that little bit of drop that we saw in the 10-year yield, because that's what it seems everything is tied to. But anyway, we'll continue. But President Trump is also arguing that the dollar strength is undermining the competitiveness of U.S. manufacturers. Everybody and their brother is claiming a recession risk is just we're going to be heading into a recession if we're not already in one. President Trump acknowledged that the world is in a recession. So if the world is in a recession, well, that's only common sense that it's just a matter of time before we're heading in there. And but there are some interesting things that I saw that Trump was going to. He wants to lower the corporate tax rate to 15%, trying to spur some more investment. Ideas also, it's also been discussed to include imposing a currency transaction tax that would weaken the dollar, should make the U.S. exports more competitive. But what do we export? We don't export that much, So it's also discussions on creating a rotation among the Federal Reserve governors that would make it easier to check the power of Jerome Powell. It's there's a lot of discussions that there's a lot of nervousness in the White House. No panic, but everybody's nervous, and they should be. It should be a panic. And there was an interesting, everybody blames the trade war, China. China's getting blamed for it. China decided to add additional tariffs on, I think, $85 billion. It wasn't that much. It was, what, 5 and 10%, I believe. So it really wasn't that much. But it's just the idea. Everyone, the leaders are in a G7 meeting, and of course, that's basically what all they're talking about. I mean, it really is incredible. It was $75 billion that Beijing is slapping on additional tariffs. Let me see if I can find any additional information on that. I had that right before coming on, and my apologies for being a little bit unprepared for this one, but it's been a hectic day when gold is up $30 and the markets are down, 600 points. The targets for China's retaliation, I believe, is going to hit soybeans, cars, and oil. American cars, soybeans, and oil are among the thousands of products that China is targeting for these additional tariffs and making the latest volley in a widening trade war. China announced this Friday, saying they would increase these existing tariffs by 5 to 10% on more than 5,000 U.S. products in several stages starting in September. The value of these products is estimated by the Chinese Commerce Ministry to total around $75 billion. This retaliatory move reflects this latest escalation in this trade dispute. And I can't imagine when Trump gets, I can't imagine that this is going to be not addressed. We knew President Trump was ready to put these, our own trade tariffs on China come September 1st, and they were delayed. Part of them were delayed. So we'll have to see if he decides to follow through and change his mind. We know he changes his mind a lot. The U.S. imports 4.5 times as many goods from China than the other way around, but the Chinese government, as it's done in the past, appears to be singling out American-made products, largely in Midwestern states that Trump carried in 2016 election that he needs to win re-election. Yeah, I don't know about that. I mean, most of our manufacturing is, that's where it's done. That's where our soybeans are. You're not going to see New York City grow soybeans. So it's just part of that country where, you know, it does have an impact. I'm sure, you know, China's picking and choosing just like we had. Maybe they are targeting that. Maybe they are sending a message to President Trump saying that they can, you know, control his reelection. But then where is the Democrats screaming about China's trying to interfere with our elections? Where are they screaming? Oh, is it just Russia that's trying to interfere with our elections? Where are all these Democrats? We have Iowa as the largest producer of soybeans. Michigan and Ohio have left the biggest concentration of have the biggest concentration of auto manufacturing. And Trump barely won in Michigan. The two countries do continue to negotiate, but, you know, it's the same thing, but this has really moved to a different level, I believe. And is this the beginning of the unwinding? September is the most volatile month of the year. People are coming back from vacations. Kids are beginning to go back to school. Distractions. People are going to be looking at their portfolios, and they're going to be seeing all these big drops in the rise of gold. And Bitcoin did well today, too, but it is not a safe haven. Bitcoin is not a safe haven. Only gold. Give us a call. 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Headlines are crazy, ladies and gentlemen. We don't have time to talk much about them. We have a great blog out today. So make sure you get to our website at dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com. Sign up for it. It was already released, but we can get you another one sent out. And we appreciate you joining us today. When we come back from break, it'll be myself and James Corbett. So please stay tuned. It's a great conversation, ladies and gentlemen. And we'll be back in just a few short minutes.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. TalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I'm here with my guest, James Corbett. And, of course, he's the founder and editor of the Corbett Report. And as we all know, it was founded in 2007. Boy, time does go by too fast, I should say. And in 2012, of course, he became the lead editorial writer for the International Forecaster that was created by Robert Chapman. And so, visit James's website at thecorbettreport.com, thecorbettreport.com, and you can also request a complimentary copy of the International Forecaster just by going to their website, theinternationalforecaster.com. James, before we get started, would you like to expound a little bit on the Corbett Report? And any just information and how you, what moves you to write on various topics, your goals, and
sure, yes, yeah. I can tell you about the founding impetus for the Corbett Report. It was really in 2006, and it was a pretty humdrum, mundane event in my life here in Japan. I was teaching English, and I was just moving into a new apartment building at that time, and this apartment building came with an internet connection. I didn't have my internet in my apartment before that point here in Japan, so it had been a couple of years since I had had an internet connection. And so I'd just been going to internet cafe to check my email kind of thing, but, you know, obviously wasn't really connected. So 2006, I get connected. Suddenly I can browse to my heart's content. And at that particular time, you may remember YouTube was a brand new thing at that time, and Google Video and other services like that existed. And it was kind of the Wild West time, where there was no copyright. So people were just posting everything, or people were not respecting copyright, shall we say. And so, basically, whatever I was interested in, I could just watch. And for me, I'd always been interested in politics and documentaries and things like that. And you can get so much of that by watching, you know, PBS or what have you back in North America, but only in little bits here and there. But here I could just watch that kind of stuff all the time. So I was doing that. And it was, I think, it's a process I talked about in a podcast I did last year called Pricking the Filter Bubble, where I was sitting there every day watching YouTube, you know, Colbert Report and things like that. But on the sidebar or whatever, however it looked at that time, I don't even remember how YouTube used to look, but they would keep recommending videos to me about 9/11. And I would click on it sometimes. I was very firmly of the opinion that, yeah, I mean, conspiracies happen, and, you know, JFK wasn't killed by a lone nut, but 9/11, that's crazy. You know, I wouldn't go there. But just sometimes I would click on a video that looked interesting on the sidebar there or recommended, and it would be some sort of 9/11 truth video, and some of them were just ridiculous about flying orbs bringing down the towers and things like that. And so I would roll my eyes and go back to watching whatever I was watching. But occasionally there would be an interesting clip, something that caught my attention, some sort of fact about whatever it was, Operation Northwoods, or some claim by French intelligence that CIA met bin Laden in hospital in July 2001 or something like that. And I'd see something like that and I'd go, well, that can't be true. And so I'd go and I'd look it up and I'd go, oh, well, that was reported in The Guardian. And here, you know, here's the article. And, oh, or, you know, here's the actual document, Operation Northwoods. I've never heard about that before. How come? And so it was that process that got the ball rolling. And suddenly I started digging deeper and deeper into it, and the more I dig, the more I would search things out and see things that I'd never seen before. So it was in late 2006 that, in the newspeak of our modern political parlance, I got radicalized on the internet into becoming a conspiracy theorist, which we now know is equated to domestic terrorism. Anyway, so that's how the ball got rolling, and it wasn't long before I started thinking to myself, well, this is incredible. All this information that I'm seeing, and I can go out and I can verify and I can read the documents and things that obviously have been there for some time, but no one has ever talked to me about this before. I've never seen this on the news. They aren't talking about this in any sort of mainstream programming. I wonder why. So I thought to myself, well, this is outrageous. I have to bring this information to other people. And my initial impetus, actually, at the time, my initial thought was, oh, I know what I can do. I can physically burn CDs of podcasts and things that I was listening to, and I could give them out to people here in Japan, which was ridiculous because, I mean, other than my expat friends, I mean, no one even knows English here, really. So it was just a non-starter idea. But then it didn't take long for it to occur to me, oh, this is the internet age. Why don't I put out internet information? So I, for the first time in my life, I'd never given a second thought to it before, but suddenly I was like, oh, I should start a website. And it wasn't long, I really had the whole idea for what my website was going to be like and what I wanted to do. I wanted to start a podcast. And since it was the internet and something I found frustrating with the podcasts I was listening to at that time, I didn't think people were taking advantage of the internet the way that it's designed. Here you can hyperlink directly to documents and articles and things that you're talking about. Why not do that? So I had the image in my head. I was going to do a podcast and I would have the documents there. So when I say, you know, the Guardian reported this on April 4th, 2004 or whatever, I would have a direct link to that document. And so that was really the founding vision of the Corbett Report. And it really only took a few months from that founding vision to getting a friend of mine here to design the first iteration of the Corbett Report website. I got the domain, I got the hosting, I got it set up, I got it ready to go. I recorded the first podcast. I cringe to go back to that podcast at this point because it was not very polished, shall we say, but I was a complete beginner. I'd never studied any of this, never thought I would be doing it, but I felt compelled to do it. And that was really the founding vision. And essentially, I mean, everything that came after that was just the snowball rolling downhill. I started, it was just going to be a podcast, but pretty soon I realized, well, I need to write some articles. I should be interviewing people. I got to do videos, you know, I got to put stuff up on YouTube. So it all just kind of developed from there. But that was the founding sort of impetus for this. I saw the discrepancy between the information that was being reported in the mainstream sources and the information that I could verify and I could see for myself online. And I thought, I got to bridge that gap somehow and put this information out. And never in my wildest imagination would I have imagined that I would have reached millions, literally millions of people around the world with my voice just by putting it out there.
Well, that's fascinating. I'm sure glad you did because, I mean, I trust you. There's a lot of stuff you can find on the internet. There's a lot of videos and information, and I know I trust a certain group that I know when you say something, I know the research is there.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate yes. the sentiment, but I certainly – that's why I put the documents there because I don't ask people to trust me. I ask people to look at the documents. Generally, when I'm putting something together that I think is important, I'm doing it because I want to draw attention to the documents or whatever it is that I'm talking about so that people will go there for themselves and not just trust me or anyone else. Because we're all, at the end of the day, I mean, I know I'm not an agent and I'm not trying to mislead people, but I'm human and I do make mistakes and I can misinterpret or I have my own viewpoint that doesn't take into account this or that. So here's the documents. Please look at them. And that's really what I consider my goal is to get people to look and engage more in the process of constructing a narrative rather than simply taking someone else's narrative on board. Even mine. I don't ask people to take my narrative. I say, look at the information and put it into this picture. And sometimes it can be frustrating because I have a picture in my head of how this all slots together, but it's impossible to articulate such a big picture all at once. So it takes a long time and I have to keep coming back around and looking at the same subjects from different perspectives. And something like my big oil documentary, I mean, it's really hard to articulate that in a few sentences. It takes hours putting this and this and this and this and this piece here and this piece there. And finally, people, I think, can start to see the bigger picture. But it takes a lot of effort. So, it's the kind of thing, unless you're producing content like this, it's hard for people to even understand how difficult it is to put this into words and put it in a logical way.
And I agree with you. I think people need to, when they need to do their own research, their own reading to confirm. But I also have that, still, I still have that trust in you, because I don't have the time when I'm working during the day. Sometimes I don't have the time to do all my own research. And so that's the kind of trust that I have on certain websites and so forth. I know you guys do that strong research. And, but yes, I always encourage folks to look around, read, because there's a lot of there's a lot of fake news out there, ladies and gentlemen. But, you know, you do documentaries, and I just became Netflix. I don't pay attention to that stuff, but I guess I was just bored one night, and I thought, well, you know, I guess I'll do Netflix. And they had this documentary on there, and it's called The Family. And I don't know why this has kind of gotten underneath my skin, or I just want to learn a little bit more about it. I don't know if you have heard, but The Family, it's also known as The Fellowship, or I should say The Fellowship is also known as The Family and the International Foundation. Have you heard of them?
I have heard of them, and I've heard of this documentary specifically. I've had several people email me about it, but I don't have Netflix, so I have not seen the documentary.
Well, you know, you could, it's, you've heard of the National Prayer Breakfast that's held in Washington?
Yes, I have.
Well, I guess the fellowship is the one who holds this event each year. And I didn't, and this fellowship is a little weird. They're kind of brought together by the you know, as Wikipedia has it, the common love of the teachings of Jesus, but they don't, from the documentary, they say it's a very secretive type group, of course, and it is to teach the youth coming up how to rule the world. You know, so it is all about influencing politics in various parts of the world and so forth. And they don't deal with the lower echelon, I guess. They don't consider themselves quote unquote Christians, I guess. But they're the hierarchies to where they believe, you know, and it was really, I only saw a small part of it. And I wanted to ask you if you had heard of them, if you, you know, so it's...
Yeah, I have heard of that, and things like the Council on National Policy and other groups like this that don't get as much attention as the Council on Foreign Relations and groups like that. And so I am aware of that. I think that the CFR and Bilderberg and Trilaterals do just wield more influence than some of these other groups. But that doesn't say that they're not important or people shouldn't be looking into them. I think there is definitely a large part of, I mean, let's put it this way. Essentially, it's about an ideology. And if it's in the corridors of power in Washington and it involves high-profile political figures, it's going to be about how we can rule people better.
Right.
At the end of the day, that's the common shared ideology of these Congress critters and others.
But, you know, I always thought that the National Prayer Breakfast was just preachers, you know, getting together, you know, doing a prayer, getting together for breakfast. I didn't know that it was, you know, led and held by this so-called fellowship. And anyway, let's go ahead and move on. Let's see. Your most recent article in the Corbett Report is called Hong Kong, Chaos Before the Order. And we have, you start this article by observing that the current pro-democracy protests in Hong Kong have their roots in the Hong Kong Policy Act passed by Congress in 1992. You report that the U.S. has also funded millions of dollars of programs over the years through the National Endowment for Democracy to help promote this democracy in Hong Kong. And does Washington's, and tell us about it, and does Washington's involvement in the protests delegitimize the movement itself? And where does that leave us looking from the outside in on a situation like this?
Yeah, this is essentially what I'm grappling with in this article. It's less so about the Hong Kong protest movement itself, and you know the specific issue and the extradition bill and all of that stuff. It's not so much about that. It's about that fundamental issue of is Washington involved in manipulating and stirring up protests, and B, if so, does that delegitimize the freedom movement in Hong Kong generally? That's a fundamental issue, and it keeps coming up in place after place, like Kashmir, which I imagine we might talk about later.
Yes.
But there's a lot of places where essentially the local population find themselves in a position where they are advocating for independence or freedom or something like that, but they're also being used in a proxy war between two, you know, bigger powers. And so we come in from an outside perspective thinking, oh, well, okay, so these guys are involved, so we have to be on the other side. And it always kind of gets abstracted away from, well, what about the people there? What do they think, and what do they believe? And shouldn't this be their concern rather than ours? And I think it's just something that strikes me, because I see a lot of even the independent media coverage of these types of things tends to get simplified to the point where, okay, here's the National Endowment for Democracy, which is essentially a cover for the CIA. It's just the CIA by another means, essentially, interfering in local politics. If you need more on that, go to corporatereport.com/NGO. And I did a podcast a couple of years ago talking about the National Endowment for Democracy and other groups like this that essentially go in and stir up color revolutions or whatever the State Department needs by funding protest groups and what have you. And we can determine. I mean, the NED has been pumping millions of dollars into Hong Kong over the last several years and funding opposition groups. There's the picture of a senior State Department official meeting with the Hong Kong protester leaders and things like this. So we know that Washington does have its snoot in what is happening in Hong Kong and is trying to stir up or foster the protest movement. But does that mean then that the protesters have no point, or that we should be therefore in favor of China clamping down on these protests? And so when we see the Chinese coming in with like the police dressing up as protesters undercover so that they can make arrests in the crowd and making brutal arrests, beating people to pulp and things like that, we should overlook that, or though that's because there's troublemakers in the crowd that have been funded by the U.S. It's all about the simplification. Good guys, bad guys, here it is. And it's never quite that simple, is it? And so this is something I keep coming back to. I think fundamentally I'm in support of people who want independence and freedom. And yeah, there's going to be ways in which that's going to be manipulated, and people are going to use those people, and people are going to be funding those protests and going in and what have you, and it's a proxy war. And I understand that bigger picture, but it has to include the participation of the actual Hong Kongers. And when I have people who are not Hong Kongers telling me that people who want independence from China are all U.S. stooges, or people who love China are great people, or whatever it is, I mean, whatever angle that people have, if you're not from Hong Kong, why should your opinion on that be of any consequence whatsoever? I mean, the whole point is to simply support people's natural desire for independence. And that's kind of the issue I keep circling around, because as I say, I keep seeing these types of events popping up in different places around the globe. It happens to be happening in Hong Kong right now, but it is it troubles me the way that this is simplified into this kind of greater power conflict, when it's essentially it's about a local population striving for independence of some sort.
We're heading into a break right now, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back. I'm Melody Cedarstrom with James Corbett. Please stay tuned.
Just one more time. Oh, won't you tell me again? Oh, can you feel it? Oh, won't you tell me again?
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com, or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today. today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and I'm here with James Corbett. We're talking about Hong Kong, what's going on over there, the chaos. And how do you think this particular crisis will end? And then if we would like to go in and talk about, you did an article 2 weeks ago, you wrote about the crisis in Kashmir.
Right. Well, I'm tempted to say that I'm not a crystal ball kind of guy, but I do write for a newsletter called The Forecaster, so I suppose I should have an answer to a question like that, right? I would say that it's not going to end anytime soon, even if there is some sort of resolution to the current conflict in Hong Kong. These issues are not all going to be settled, and it's going to continue to be a struggle. However, this particular issue and these particular protests end up. So it seems to me, I tend to be on the side of the people who think that China is not going to crack down militarily and send their troops across the border. We're going to take control because obviously Hong Kong can't sort it out for themselves. I don't think they're going to go that far this time, but that is a possibility down the road. And so as I say, I don't think I think that this current round of protests, like the umbrella movement a few years ago, is going to die down, is going to tamp down. Essentially the main ostensible goal of the protests when they began has already been reached. They wanted that extradition bill that they were going to bring in. They wanted it scrapped. Well, it's been shelved. It's not completely obliterated. They're not saying they'll never pass it ever, but it has been shelved for the time being. They're not going to go ahead with it. They're probably not going to get the current Hong Kong governor to step down, but they've already reached at least their ostensible goal. So now it's just kind of an amorphous democracy protest kind of thing, which doesn't have a particular goal, so it's not going to reach any particular conclusion in that sense. I think the protests will just die down. I don't think the Chinese are going to be sending in their military at this point. But, as I say, this is still an open, festering, boiling issue, and it's going to keep coming up until there is some sort of dramatic movement one way or another.
Considering President Xi's stance in the world, he's dealing with the trade war with President Trump, his issues with, I mean, these are two big issues for him, to how
not
he's
the only
going
ones,
to, but not the only ones, but they're, well, you know, the economy and everything else, but I mean, these are two, I don't know if you would consider them more international.
Absolutely.
That his decisions on how he ends these will liken his future in the international
arena,
world of politics arena.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I mean, the next several years are going to be absolutely fundamental for charting the course for China in the 21st century, and how Xi Jinping manages to thread the needle or not thread the needle with the trade war, with Hong Kong, with Shenzhen, with all these other things that are coming up, with the development of the Belt and Road Initiative, or does it stall? Does it fail? Does it get roadblocked in places like Kashmir or what have you? I mean, there's a million different things that can develop and will be coming to head in the next several years that will really determine the 21st century. Is this going to be a Chinese 21st century, or will they at least be a major player? Or will they be like, you know, 20 years from now, will we be looking at China like we look at Japan? You know, back in the 80s, everyone thought Japan was rule the world, but now it's like, huh, you know, Japan. Will that be the fate for China? I think that's being decided with things like this, and will be going one way or another in the next several years.
Well, you wrote about the crisis in Kashmir and Jammu. Did I pronounce that properly? And
probably. Jammu and Kashmir? I don't know.
And You discuss what it means for the future, what you call one of the most heavily militarized. Militarized, thank you. And the volatile geopolitical fault lines in the world, Pakistan and India. What is your insights about this intensifying predicament?
Yeah. Well, this is one of those things where it's hard to talk about it without having some historical insight and context. And I'm certainly no scholar on the history of Kashmir and all of this. So this is one of those times where I would hope people would go and look at some of the documentation that I'm linking to that could describe it in much greater detail. But essentially, when India and when British colonial India was transferred over to India as a dominion, and was partitioned, India and Pakistan. At that time, there were several states that were kind of loosely allied to India that decided to sign instruments of accession to become part of India in some sense. Kashmir was one of those. It was ruled over by this Hindu king priest class, or not priest class, like a princely state, essentially, that had its own autonomy and was thinking, well, maybe we could be independent, but there were some attacks and chaos and things going on at the time. So they said, no, we're going to sign up to become part of India, but a special sovereign part of India. And so there was a special clause inserted in the Indian Constitution that allowed Kashmir to decide through its constituent assembly what parts of the Indian Constitution would apply to Kashmir and what wouldn't. They had some rights to make their own laws. There was even a provision put in that only Kashmir residents, or people who were officially recognized as being Kashmiris, could own land in Kashmir and thus had certain privileges and amenities. Indians from other part of India couldn't just flood into the region and basically take it over, kind of thing. So it has for decades enjoyed some form of autonomy within India. But to what extent? And that's been a sticky issue over the years. And in, for example, 1990, there was a kind of uprising that was going on. An important thing to understand is Kashmir, formerly the state of Jammu and Kashmir, now it's going to be divided into two regions, Kashmir and Ladakh, that are going to be federally administered. But it's a Muslim-majority area, which, of course, in India is the only example of that, because obviously it's a heavily Hindu nation. So it has had an uneasy relationship with the Indian government at times, and in 1990 there was a type of uprising that was happening there, so India sent in the military in a bigger fashion, and it's been under some form of almost a military-style occupation for some time now, and there's been chaos and what have you. But this all came to a head on August 5th when the Indian Home Office Secretary, whatever it's called, presented a change in that Indian Constitution, Article 370, which was the one that granted that kind of semi-quasi-autonomy to the Kashmir region. What they did was some legal maneuvering to strip Kashmir of that semi-autonomy and to say that it's essentially going to be under federal government control now. And that is a huge change in the status quo. Now, the important thing to keep in mind about this region for people who don't know about the map, there is a Indian-occupied part of Kashmir. There's a Pakistani part that's across something called the line of control, which is essentially kind of a border of sorts. It's not an official border, but it's militarized, and you've got India and Pakistan, two nuclear nations that hate each other's guts right across the border from each other in that extremely volatile area. And you also have a piece of the Kashmir region that is claimed by China. So you have three nuclear-armed nations that have all been at war at various times in recent history. So it's a very, very volatile place. And so for India to come and say, okay, now we're taking our part of this and we're splitting it into two territories and we're removing its sovereignty and we're taking it over federally, it's a huge move. It's a huge change in the status quo. It's almost, perhaps not quite to the scale, but it's almost like if China went in and tried to take over Taiwan or something. I mean, it's a huge change in the status quo, and obviously Pakistan is very upset with this. Obviously China is unhappy with it. Even the US and the UN and others have been saying, you know, let everyone stay calm, we shouldn't be making any drastic moves. So it seems to me like India does not have many friends in this maneuver, which is why it's kind of puzzling. Why now? The Indian Prime Minister Modi did just win a pretty handsome majority in the Indian Parliament, so he may feel that he has kind of a mandate from the voters to pursue the hardline Hindu nationalist kind of ideals that, that his party espouses, but is this the way to do it? I mean, it's a major move, and clearly this is going to cause chaos. It hasn't quite caused chaos yet, but only because the region has been on this incredible lockdown to the point where internet and mobile communications and what have you has have all been shut off. Some of that has been restored in certain areas, but there are still apparently some Kashmiris who don't even know what has taken place over the last few weeks. They just know that there's been a clampdown of some sort and they can't talk to each other. There's curfews imposed, all this, I mean, all this kind of stuff going on. Once that starts to get eased, one can imagine there's going to be protests, there's going to be violence, there's going to be problems. And as the Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan was pointing out when India made this move, yeah, there's going to be protests and there's going to be violence as a result of this because the Kashmiris are not going to be happy about this change. And when that happens, India is going to blame Pakistan for it. They're going to say, look, they're stirring up these Muslims to try to create problems with India. So now India is going to retaliate against Pakistan and start off some sort of war. So you can see how quickly something like this can snowball into something much bigger between two nuclear armed powers that hate each other. This is not a good turn of events.
And your prediction, your insights, your what do you expect?
Yeah,
it's just a wait and see.
Yeah, I wouldn't have actually predicted that they would have made a move like this, especially out of nowhere. No one was seeing this. No one was predicting this. They weren't making any sort of ostensible plans that they were going to do anything like this. It just happened overnight and just immediately. So that's the thing that's surprising to me. It's the kind of thing I don't think Modi could back away from this at this point let's reconsider. I don't think he can do that without losing political face and thus likely losing office. So I think he has to go forward with it now. But Pakistan, I don't think, are just going to lie down and take this. And we already saw, I was just writing about it a few months ago, there was already some back and forth that was going on, some military skirmishes, including India sending fighter jets over the line of control into Pakistani territory just earlier this year over some military skirmishes that were taking place. I don't see a way of putting a lid on that. So unfortunately, I see escalation from here. I don't know who would be able to come in as a mediator in this at this point. And I don't, as I say, I don't see Modi backing down from this.
So, you know, there was a lot of discussions this week about Trump wanting to buy Greenland. Is that a strategic move for, you know, future unrest in various parts of the world?
I have no idea. I saw that headline, thought it was a joke, and then, oh no, apparently that's real. I didn't really look into that story, so I don't know even what Trump is saying the ostensible reason for that is, or if this is all just some sort of distraction.
No.
We are in a very strange political reality this point days, so I don't know what that is meant to signal. But
one thing I do know is Greenland has, I believe, the purest water in the world.
Well, water is going to be a key resource
for
the 21st century, so that definitely could play a part in it.
Yes.
But I mean, who really thinks Denmark is just going to, oh, okay, we'll sell it to you, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. It's just a bizarre move. I would think that is not going to portend the way that things like this will be settled in the future, but you never know at this point. I mean, all bets are off the table, I guess.
Well, Japan warns that North Korea now has miniaturized nukes and is an imminent threat. What do you hear about that? And it's just another part of the world that it's not over yet.
No. And I think that's the important point about this. I can't verify whether or not North Korea has miniaturized nukes into warheads, or, I mean, well, I guess we'll find out if and when they test it. But it is interesting that this isn't, you might remember a year or two ago, this was the existential threat. It was on, you know, the top story of the news, the Korean crisis, all of this. It was big news. But then, you know, Trump started the whole peace summit thing, and so everything was solved. And now that it's even worse, and they are continuing to test their weapons, and now it's at least being claimed they've miniaturized the nukes, and the threat is even greater than it was a couple of years ago. No one's talking about it because it's just not in the glare of the spotlight, and people's minds, it's a done issue. Well, it isn't a done issue. In fact, it's probably even worse now than it was, not only technologically, because they've advanced a couple of years with their warfare equipment, but also because now you've already done the peace summit thing, and that obviously hasn't resulted in any breakthroughs. So now what do you do? Now it's even harder. So, you know, I mean, this really is, it's baffling to me that this isn't, if it was an existential threat that needed to be the top story every night on the nightly news 2 years ago, there's no reason why it wouldn't be today, except for the fact that what is the existential threat top of the news is just a politically convenient lie that is told by the liars in the mainstream media whenever they need to trot an issue out. And they don't feel like trotting this issue out for right now for whatever reason. But this shows to me more than anything else how completely controlled the media narratives are.
Well, it seems like from what I read, the relationship between North and South Korea is deteriorating, and you know, there goes that pipeline down from Russia to South right. Korea. So there's a lot on the line for it just to all disintegrate for no obvious reason.
Yeah, and really because there's been no follow-up from the United States in the early peace summit promises and what have you, and no easing of sanctions or anything. They weren't going to give anything. It's essentially give up everything, give up your entire program and everything you're working towards, and then we'll start talking. And that was never a good option.
Well, thank you, James. I always enjoy our conversation. Dave Allen will join me on Monday. Everyone watch your inboxes later today for our weekly blog. Until then, have a great weekend. Stay safe. God bless. In my dreams, I have a plan. If I got me a wealthy man.